Okay, welcome everyone. Tonight is February 18th, 2019. This is the fourth of our classes on the Aruch HaShulchan. I'm supposed to finish in next week. If I need to, I'll go one more week, but we'll see what we can do. Before we begin, just a couple points. I want to respond to Bill, who actually is not with us. He told me he'd be in an airport now, but I guess he can listen to the tape. He wanted to know about the Levush, the printing, and I haven't. He had been told that there was more printing of the Levush than there was the Shulchan Aruch, and I said that's impossible. And I'm looking at it right now. Just the Levush on the Shulchan Aruch. The first printing is in Shin Nun, so Tuf Shin Nun was 1990, so that's 1590, and then there's another printing. 10 years later, and 15 years later, and then the next century. So that's four printings of the Levush on Or HaChaim in 100 years, almost 100 years. On the other hand, if you look at the Shulchan Aruch, and I'm just looking at the Shulchan Aruch here and the Ramah, I'm seeing this from the Beis Eket Sfarim, which has all the information. First printed in Krakow in Shin Lamed, that's 1570. And it's then printed again in 1578, in 1580, in 1593, in 1600, in 1607, in 1612, in 1616. So you're getting the point that even in the early time, the Shulchan Aruch with the Rama took the sails out of Rav Mordechai Jaffe's Levush. First point. Second point is, someone asked me where I got this stuff about Bernard Revel, that he was involved in revolutionary activities. Well, it's right here in Aaron Rakefet Rothkopf's book, Builder of American Jewish Orthodoxy. You'll find it on page 32 and 33 that in the Russian Revolution of 1905, Revel actually was in jail. Despite being a great Torah scholar, he also had Bundist socialist sympathies, which was not uncommon. So, and finally, one more thing, which is not relevant to anything like we said, but someone emailed me. Let me quickly say that I only because I think people will find it interesting. It's only going to take me 2 or 3 minutes, and I know from the emails that sometimes people find the preliminary comments even more interesting than some of the things we'll do. If you follow the news at all, you know that there's a lot of talk about male privilege. Not male privilege, sorry, white privilege. Whether there is white privilege or not, I'm not going to get into that. But I want to tell you just briefly now about male privilege. And what do I mean by male privilege? And I'm talking about in the fields of at least the fields that I'm doing, that it's a real thing. And I hadn't thought about it for a while till I got an email earlier this week from a woman in Israel who's doing research on the Mir Yeshiva in Morocco. The Mir Yeshiva actually brought a number of boys from Morocco to America, and she wants to find out. So she thought that since I have Haredi connections, I could help her, put her in contact with people. And then she says, but there might be a problem because I'm a woman. And that just shows you the male privilege. So let me explain what that means. I mean, we men take it for granted, especially those of us who are in yeshiva circles. I once said that, and a woman got, I think, got upset with me, but it's absolutely correct. I once said that my biography on Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg never could have been written by a woman. And the same is true for the 2 volumes I published. Of Rabbi Weinberg's letters. And the same is true about the book of mine that's going to appear in about 3 months, God willing. What do I mean, never could have been written by a woman? Because to write those things, I needed to get letters from rabbis. So, for instance, how did I walked right into the Chevron Yeshiva. You're not going to have a woman walk right into the Chevron Yeshiva. Found the Rosh Yeshiva, schmoozed with him. We went up to his apartment. I assume this is from Yaakov Chaim Sarna. He was perhaps a widower there then. I don't know. But it was only him and I in the room, and we schmoozed, and then I did this with other people. That's how I got all the letters. That's how I got for this course. I get so much information. A woman in the Orthodox, certainly the ultra-Orthodox, the Haredi world, could never have that sort of access. A woman can't walk into the base medrash of the yeshiva. These Rosh Yeshiva aren't going to speak to her. She can't have correspondence with them. So in that sense, there's male privilege that, again, I just took it for granted all those years that I was able to walk in. Even today, I can go to Mea Shearim and I can go to people's houses and look for things. Moshe Idel actually makes this point in the introduction to one of his books, speaking about, we have many great women scholars who deal with Kabbalah, in medieval times. But if you want to deal with contemporary Mkubalim, how is a woman supposed to have anything to do with it? How can she? She can't have access. She can't join any Kabbalistic chevra or, go to the, when Rav Getz used to have learn at the Kotel at midnight or something. So there's no question that there is a male privilege. And it really, it's found, and it's not only found in the Haredi world, it's found in the modern Orthodox world as well. A woman can't just walk into the Beis Medrash of YU and start speaking to Rosh Yeshiva. So I think we have to be honest and acknowledge that when you get into study of, let's say, modern Haredi society in rabbinic, the sort of things we do in this class, there is definitely a male privilege. And as I said, as men, we just take it for granted. We don't even realize. And I hadn't thought about it for a number of years until the woman emailed me. And then she said, but how is she going to make these connections? She said, I'm a woman. I'm a religious woman. But she says, are they going to even speak to me? And yes. So unless she's connected to Dr. David or it's still the same thing. You can it'll help. It'll help. You still, at the end of the day, the woman can't do the same thing. It's a man's world. Even today, it's a man's world in those circles, and it would be very difficult, even for Rebbetzin Farbstein, for her to get access. She would need to have. You just can't walk and knock on the door and go in. So it makes it a lot difficult, and I'm very sympathetic to it. And I didn't mean, obviously, when I said a woman could not write the book on Weinberg, that she doesn't have the ability. Of course, she has the ability. It's just that she would never have the access, never have the ability to walk in as I did and start speaking and sitting with them for hours. It just, they would, some of these people don't even speak to women. I would assert to these great rabbis. That's, and if the person who emailed me is listening, I just want you to know that she's not listening live, if she's going to be listening in tape. That your email to me raised this thing which I had been thinking about for years ago, and it brought it back to me. Yes, Barash, she can get a male intermediary, obviously, but it's not so simple. And okay, if you have any questions or you want to return to that, I see Eva's raised her hand. I don't know how you raise your hands actually on this, but Eva, you can write in the bottom there, and at the end I'll come back to it. If anyone wants to go into this further. Okay, I want to pick up where I left off. We're in the, I was reading for you sections of, here it is again, let me show it to you. The introduction of the Aruch HaShulchan. Well, it's not an introduction, it's this statement, Kvod Melech, which it begins by saying you're supposed to listen to the king, the word of the king. Actually, I have something here. Oh, where is it? I don't even know. You're supposed to listen to the word of the king. And so let me pick up with that because this is important. Okay, let me put this away here. And the last thing I mentioned was that the Aruch HaShulchan in this points out that those Jews who observe the Torah, they've never been involved in revolutionary activities. And then he goes on to say that. He talks about the anti-Semites have invented this idea that we use the blood libel, that we use the blood of non-Jews for in Passover, and he completely rejects that. And then he says that everyone should listen, be it in Moscow, in Pressburg, in Berlin, in Vienna. He says there's no, you will not. He says that I am sitting here in Lithuania and I, Nishba Anochi, I swear that we do not, our people are not Ganavim. because they all said that the Jews take advantage and do things like that. He says, look around in all these cities, Moscow, etc., Paris, London, you don't really have, he says, just a few fraudulent people. And then he goes on to say that in our area there's 16,000 Jews. And I know exactly what they're doing, that they're working hard, they're bringing home food for their families, they live difficult lives, and very few of them have any land or anything. He says, I've seen how they work. And he says, if the government would give, allow them to buy land, then they would see how good things are for them. Says that because we don't, she's trying to say that any problems we have, let me read, I can read you actually in the English here. Any problems we have is because, we're being, the people, they're forced into business and all these sort of things. Here, may the heavens be astonished, et cetera, if they cannot find amongst themselves a few deceitful people. Is the presence of such a few people a sign of their wicked hearts? In other words, it's a few Jews who do bad things, but they're tiny numbers, and you can't blame the Jewish community about that. And then he says, this is where it gets really interesting. He says, I'm just reading from the translation now. It's for this reason that recruits are missing when there's this conscription to the military in November. He's saying, why don't Jews line up and welcome, the fact that they can serve the glorious Tsar? He says, because in these cold months, they're out serving, trying to find food for them, their families, and make money. And he says, if they would have enough, money that they could clothe themselves properly, etc., they would holchim besimcha lavod. That's the Tsar, Yerum Hodo. He says that if they weren't so busy making money so to feed themselves, to acquire the basic things so that they survive, they would go joyfully to serve our master, the Tsar. And then he continues on. He says as well, he says that if they have everything they need, we'll be able to fulfill our quota. And again, he says that the people holech besimcha will go in joy. Now, no one reading this who knows anything about Jewish history can believe that this is a frank statement. Obviously, the Jews tried to get out of the draft as much as they could. It was a terrible life for everyone, but certainly for Jews, because we're not, this isn't the era where they served 25 years, but still, you're in an anti-Semitic environment, and the soldiers, their lives are worth nothing then. And then he goes on to say that they say about the Jews that they take advantage of the non-Jews. He's talking here about the idea that Jews used to have inns. Believe it or not, Jews owned inns. They sold liquor. You'd Glen Dinner from Swarthmore has a whole book about the Jewish innkeeper. So this idea that the Jews would get the non-Jew drunk and take advantage of him, and he goes on to say that any non-Jew who has a complaint against the Jew can go to the rabbi. And we'll take care of it. He says, we preach that according to our Torah, it is more prohibited to teach a non-Jew, to tr cheat a non-Jew, than it is to treat a Jew. He says, the non-Jews know who dwell in the villages will not permit themselves to be deceived. The nation of Israel in our generation is far from the wicked thoughts such as this. I know from many tavern keepers that if the tavern keeper sees that his customer is almost drunk, he will not give him additional alcohol. So and that's and then he ends it, Yechi Adoneinu, our master, the Kaiser, Alexander HaShlishi, should live, and the family should succeed, etc., the royal household, etc., etc. So that's the first of the examples of where some of this is true. I mean, they believed in respecting the Tsar, but certainly this idea that they happily, willingly go to the army, I think there's probably some exaggeration here in terms of the cheating going on. We know that Jews were involved in smuggling and all sorts of things. It was very difficult to make a living. In fact, I would go so far as to say, and again, I'll probably be called an anti-Semite, but I would go so far as to say that a lot of the shenanigans you see in the Haredi world about cheating the government go back to this sense not just in Tsarist Russia and Poland and elsewhere, that it's okay to cheat the government. Now, I know people say, well, in the modern Orthodox world, they do it too. But the difference is, in the modern Orthodox world, they do it as individuals, and no one talks about it. It's privately, and maybe, it's not, and they actually know they're wrong. In the Haredi world, institutions do it. Yeshivas do it. I've never heard of a modern Orthodox institution involved in cheating the government or anything like that, but it's part of the culture. I believe, especially the more right wing you go, it's even more ingrained that they continue acting as if they're living under Tsarist Russia. So I think that there was more of that than the Aruch HaShulchan is willing to let on. But certainly the rabbis always opposed this because they knew that when Jews would be caught smuggling, and before that, the counterfeit currency and everything, there are even passages that describe these people as road fiends. Because once one of these people are caught, then the entire Jewish community is blamed for it. So if you read carefully the Kavod Melech, you see back and forth. Some things are true, some things are only said for the eye of the Tsar, the censor. And this is an important point that we're going to see more of now. So let's move forward. The Aruch HaShulchan and his attitude towards the government, the Tsarist government, becomes the point of a great dispute in our generation, the generation before us, and a great dispute between two great figures. Maybe one we'll do classes on. One is Menachem Alon. Menachem Alon was a Supreme Court justice. He died. Maybe, I mean, he wasn't that young, but he certainly wasn't as old as people live today. But maybe he died before his time. I only knew him from Harvard when he was a visiting professor there. In fact, I don't know. Hold on a second. I keep saying, I mean, he died just shortly after that, but I'm going to pull it up now when I'll see exactly. Maybe I'm wrong on his, because when I spoke to him, he seemed. Yeah, no, I'm wrong. He died at 90, but he was certainly, when I knew him just not long before, I should say I knew him, spoke to him, he was in good condition. But maybe, fortunately, I guess, before the worst of his son came out, Mordechai Alon. We spoke about this Mordechai Alon a few years back when the first scandal came out with him, and then. Course, recently you have the second scandal, which should never have taken place, the second scandal, because had they dealt with the first scandal the way they should have dealt with it, there never would have been an opportunity for a second scandal. And in any event, Menachem Alon, not only was he a Supreme Court Justice of the State of Israel, he was a great Talmid Chacham, someone out of the from the Hebron Yeshiva, and his writings, his decisions, his judicial decisions are really they're halachic treatises, and he wrote some very important ones. And he argued in his book Mishpat Ivri, I believe that's where he does, that the courts in the state of Israel are not to be regarded as our cult. This idea of these non-Jewish courts that the rabbis tell us to avoid, that they're somewhere in the middle between a based and our coast, but they're not. And he thought that obviously he thought that these were acceptable. He had a dispute with a great rabbi, one of the great religious Zionist rabbis, author of this book among many others, Chavos Ben Yamin, known as Rav Shaul Yisraeli, one of the Rosh Yeshiva at Merkaz Harav Yeshiva. So what was the dispute about? There was a case. This is going back. Yeah, I don't have a date here in the Tshuva of Yisraeli. It's in the 90s when there was this guy. He had, as I recall, he might have even committed murder. I don't remember the details. No, wasn't murders. Okay, it was violence. Yeah, and alimut. I guess that's violence. In any event, he escaped and he ran away to Israel. And France asked for his extradition. So Israel didn't have an extradition treaty then with France. And the question was, is it permitted for Jewish state, according to halacha, to extradite someone. Now, state of Israel isn't necessarily interested in halacha, but when this came before the Supreme Court, Menachem Elon, everything he decided, he wanted to look at halachically. So he argued, and then the man was extradited. He argued, absolutely yes. And what was his basis for arguing it? Well, it was that Aruch HaShulchan in Choshen Mishpat, I think I have it here, 388, that's Shin Pei Zion, Halacha 7. Let me read it to you what it says. If not, I'll summarize it for you. I believe I need a copy of it here. And I have the book. He says as follows. After talking about the law of Mesira, handing over a Jew to non-Jew, he says, everyone knows that in the early times, Bizman HaKadmon, in the faraway lands, no one had any security. As you walk down the street and you could be robbed, to be from your goof, it says, and from your money, from robbers, etc. Even if they had a position, that is a governmental position, they could still, there was no justice. They could still pressure you. The local duke could pressure you to give up your money. And then he says, this is the case even today in Eza Medino, Africa. If you go to certain places in Africa where you have, you know, extortion and robbery. And then he says, but we have to remember how good it is. Mache Europa, the kings of Europa, and especially Adonainu, especially our Lord, the Kaiser of Russia, and his fathers, of course, his fathers also referred to famous Nicholas, the infamous Nicholas, and also the kings of England. That's going to be an important point in understanding this Aruch HaShulchan. He mentions the kings of Malchei Britannia, that they put the wings of their government, you know, in the far lands, you know, talk about England, you know, the colonialism, in order that everyone should have bitachon al gufo mamono, everyone has security, both bodily and monetarily, in order that ba'ofen sha'ashirim lo yitzarchu hastir atzmam, there's rich people don't need to hide their money anymore, because if you're rich, they can't just take your money, there's laws, and so that no one will come after the rich people and take their money and kill them. And he says, this is the basis in which the whole laws of Mesira and the Amalshim, you know, to inform on people in Shasan Poskim. And he says that's the idea of a Moser or an Amalshim. When you inform on someone or you turn someone over to one of these wicked kingdoms, the Rokfei Bagufa Mamano, if someone is informing for one of these wicked governments or wicked people where they don't have any respect on law, then you're allowed to kill that person because he's informing and people are going to be put in a difficult, perhaps even a life-threatening situation. However, if you're dealing with a legitimate government like Tsarist Russia and like Britain, in which people, they have respect for the rule of law and for property, and you can't just throw someone in jail because the king or the, you know, the Lord Mayor doesn't want, you know, wants his property, and just like Shlomo actually did with Naboth because he wanted his vineyard. If you don't have a situation like that, then the law of Mesira does not apply. So Menachem Elon cites this and says there is no concept of Mesira. There's no issue of handing over because we're handing him over to France. France is a civilized country. They're going to put him on trial. If he's innocent, he'll be freed. If he's found guilty, he'll be put in jail. And that's what the civilized countries do. And we see from the Aruch HaShulchan that don't say it's Mesira. It's handing over to the non-Jews because it doesn't apply if you're dealing with civilized kingdoms. However, Rav Shaul Yisraeli wrote a response to this. Not only the Rav Shaul Yisraeli, the Rav Shaul Yisraeli's response was published in Tchumen, which is the religious Zionist annual. And Elon responds in Tchumen to Rav Shaul Yisraeli. But Rav Shaul Yisraeli, you can see it in Tchumen, or you can see it in his Sefer Chavos Ben Yamin, Volume 1, on pages 183 on. And he's responding to Menachem Elon, and he says, after quoting what Menachem Elon says about the Aruch HaShulchan, he says that this may be l'idei gichuch. It's basically, this is laughable. He says, anyone who can look at this can see that the only reason these comments were made was, you know, for the censor. He's not going to say that there's, there's a notion of mesira, of handing over to the government, because then that's considered subversive, undermining the czarist government. So instead, he says the czarist government is a, you know, is a civilized government, but Rabbi Israeli says not just that, also what he's saying that, and he says, and therefore he gives all the praises to the czar, and he says the same thing, and he says in order to show that he wasn't like a joker, he also had to throw in these praises about Britain, because if he just said the czarist regime, no one would take it seriously. But if he said, but so he had to throw in also Britain, and he says, but anyone who looks at this will know that it's not authentic. He says, and then he goes on and says that, you know, that the Menachem Elon builds a whole notion that the whole idea that you can't use these courts only applies until the emancipation, when Jews are treated well. And Rabbi Israeli assumes, by the way, that what he says about Britain is also not to be taken seriously, because otherwise he wouldn't have argued about the France situation. And then he goes on. He calls. He uses the word timimut, which is needs naivete. Basically, saying that Menachem Elon is completely naive to think that. And the proof is it. Is the fact that it's the czarist. If he just said Britain, okay, then maybe you could maybe make the case. But the fact that he says czar and Britain, it's obvious, because clearly he doesn't refer to the czar as being a civilized government. And the fact that he throws in Britain, that's obviously just to make it so it doesn't look so ridiculous. But Britain also, you wouldn't assume, because if he's putting it together with the czarist, then he's not being authentic in any of them. And Rabbi Israeli assumes that you can't hand over, of course you have to, the Israeli government would have to punish this person themselves, but in order to prevent it from becoming a place where all these criminals go to, but they can't, you can't extradite him. In fact, his conclusion is, Asur limso af Yehudi darkos shel goyim v'chova larocho mishpat. But it's forbidden to hand over any Jew, but you have to judge him. He's not saying that we're not going to judge him. We're going to judge him also. Maybe our judgment will be even harsher than in France, but we can't hand him over. So what? Who's right? And what's the... before I read further, because this became a debate from another angle, I have to say that I think Rachel Yisraeli is correct. I don't think there's any doubt. I'm going to show you some other examples of this as well. But Rabbi Michael Broyd has an article, you can easily see it online. The title is Informing on Others for Violating American Law. And he goes into this, he goes into the different approaches and goes into the Aruch HaShulchan as well. And he says, let me just read you what he says and comment. While one can dismiss the words of the Aruch HaShulchan as put in for the censor, there are at least three logical reasons why one might conclude that the words in the text actually reflect the normative Jewish law view of the Aruch HaShulchan. So Broyd is saying that no, the Aruch HaShulchan means it, you know, it isn't just for the censor. And what are the three reasons? One, all apologetic remarks for the benefit of the censor and Choshen Mishpat in the Aruch HaShulchan are found in star footnotes in italics at the bottom of the page. This passage is found in the text and not in italics. All I can say is this statement of Broyd is absolutely incorrect, completely false. Where he gets this idea that there's no censorship in the text, we're going to see in just a couple of minutes that it's absolutely false. And so if that's the best, if that's not all he has to say. But so point number one of his is without question, completely false. Okay, point number two. His mention of the British government is unexplainable if directed to the censor. Britain and the Tsar were not allies at this time, and he is clearly referring to the British democratic tradition. Okay, well, this is wrong also. Britain and the Tsar, if you know the history, the families, they're the same family. They're connected. And when he says they were not allies at this time, they weren't at war or anything. They were there's no it's not insulting the Tsar to mention Britain. On the contrary, as I just said, the families are joined. As for he's clearly referring to the British democratic tradition, that is an interesting point. I mean, that's the point that Rav Shlomi Israeli assumes that he threw this in so it doesn't seem idiotic. That talking about the Tsar as being such a wonderful person. But I have to say that he didn't have to throw in Britain. The fact that he throws in Britain, that raises a question. So what's possible is that he actually intended this, and this is what Tzitzit Eliezer says. It could be that he, and this isn't perhaps, I don't think so, but perhaps he actually intended Britain. In other words, he meant it, that there's no Masira when you're dealing with a civilized government like the British government. That is authentic. What's not authentic is the Tsarist government. That is thrown in for the censor. But not like Broyd is saying that he actually intends the censor. I repeat what I said before. Anyone who knows anything about Jewish history in Russia cannot, in their wildest imagination, assume that, and I don't know how Elon could assume, that the Aruch HaShulchan or anyone else could say that the Tsarist government is a government of justice and all these things. But it could very well be, even though I don't think so, but I, for other reasons, but we'll see, this is Eliezer holds it, that that when dealing with the British government, the Aruch HaShulchan did think it was valid, and the only non-authentic point, that is the only thing where he's not being frank, is with the Tsarist government. And as I said, we'll see Tzitzit Eliezer in a minute. So I guess then number one, Broyd's absolutely wrong. Number two, he's half wrong. And the second point about the British democratic tradition could be correct. And the third point he says is the Aruch HaShulchan gives a logical and halachic explanation for his view, which he never does when speaking to the censor. Again, that's not correct either. I mean, we're going to see examples of this when he gives views, maybe not in such detail as this, but he does explain why it doesn't apply anymore today. We're going to talk about why you can't do conversions. He says because it's against Dina d'Malchusa Dina. So, I mean, that's that he's giving the reason why you can't do it. Does anyone really believe that the Aruch HaShulchan thought that there's a problem doing conversions in Russia? Or any? So Broyd's wrong on that one as well. Then he says, quote, "Indeed, this writer notes that one could almost state that if there is a hand of the censor, it is not in terms of the principle that informing does not apply to just governments, but to the Aruch HaShulchan's remark that the Tsar is such." Exclamation point. I forgot that Broyd said that. And that's what I just said before. And that I think he is, that's a very good point he makes. And Broyd notes that the Tzitzit Eliezer accepts this view. He does. Tzitzit Eliezer is not interested in the Tsarist government, whether he was authentic there, but the principle that the Aruch HaShulchan sets down, that when you're dealing with just governments, there's no problem of informing or anything, handing over, which Rav Shlomi Israeli thought was outrageous. Rav Eliezer Waldenberg and the Tzitzit Eliezer, you're dealing with what can only be described as a posek mufak, an important posek. He decides halacha lemaisa that that's the halacha. Broyd shows there's four approaches to the issue of Masira, and I believe that in the modern Orthodox world today, that is the accepted position. They assume there's no Masira when it comes to sexual abuse or anything like that. Well, it because the American government is a valid government, and that's the reason, incidentally, why. In the Haredi world, which has a whole different approach, they use an expression like Malchus shel Chesed, kingdom of kindness. So you don't find modern Orthodox figures using terms like that America is a kingdom of Chesed, or because that implies that it's like a kingdom. The king's over there and he treats us well. As Rav Shachter has made the point many times in dealing with taxes, is that in America, it's not a question of a king. He's not taxing us for his own personal benefit. There's no such, the government is us, we're the people. And we as Jews are just as much a part of the government as anyone else. There's no such thing. It's not like there's a Malchut Shel Chesed, a nice king over there that's going to treat us well. We're the government. and we have just as much involvement and just as much rights as anyone else. So the whole concept of the pre-modern concept of a Malchus Shel Chesed, which the Haredi world always, again and again, in talking about how you have to observe the law, they say it's a Malchus Shel Chesed. You have it's a merciful kingdom that treats us well and everything, without an understanding of modern society that we are the government. There's no such thing as the government apart from us. We are just as much a part of it as anyone else, and therefore, it's in the Haredi world, you still have these big problems when it comes to informing the government. Even when it was known that there were sexual abusers and all these terrible things, it was only the enormous lawsuits and kicking and screaming and the masses, the Haredi masses in revolt, basically, that finally led the Haredi world and the Yaguda to agree that you have to go to the government. I mean, when the history of this is written, and you see, I mean, look, when they write the history, you can imagine in 50 years, they write the history of Aguda. They'll talk about when the sexual abuse scandal became known. You know, Aguda was at the forefront of putting in safeguards and everything. But those of us who lived through this know it's just the opposite, that they fought it like the Catholic Church to avoid having any involvement with the government. And they told people, do not tell, do not go anywhere. And that's the history. And it goes back not to the Aruch HaShulchan's perspective. Goes back to the other perspective that Broid mentions. Now, in terms of censorship, Rav Nachum Rabinovich, the great Rav Nachum Rabinovich, I know there's some Toronto people listening, he has a son, because before he went to Ma'ale Adumim, he was in Toronto, and actually he was in Dallas, I believe, then he was in Charleston as a rabbi, then he was in Toronto, then he went to London, where for many years he was at Jews College, and then he comes to Ma'ale Adumim, where they found the great yeshiva. I mean, it's an amazing story that it wasn't his yeshiva. They brought him in to be the Rosh Yeshiva. People who founded it, Rav Sabata and Rav Shilat. But he has a son, a very learned son named Mordechai Rabinovich. As far as I know, he doesn't listen to the tapes, but he sends me comments on Sorian blog posts. But he wrote a commentary, I think there's only two volumes now, maybe three, on the Aruch HaShulchan. And one of the volumes deals with Hanukkah. He sent it to me. And he points out an example there where some examples of what he regards as self-censorship in the Aruch HaShulchan. And these are not in such areas, just, of Mesira, these very problematic areas. So, for instance, in his discussion of the Hanukkah story, the Aruch HaShulchan states as follows, quote, "Kishenichnesu anshe Antiochus lehecho," when the men of Antiochus went into the temple. And he says, here's an example of censorship, self-censorship. Why? Because in the Talmud, what does it say? "Kishenichnesu yevoni lehecho." Well, what do you mean? At first I was curious, I asked a friend before I didn't even bother turning to Rav Mordechai Rabinovich. I was going to write about this. Like, what does this have to do with censorship? So the Gemara says that the Greeks went in, and Rabinovich shows us that the Aruch HaShulchan says the Anshei Antiochus. That's self censorship because of fear of the censor. I thought it was far fetched. Why would the Russian government be concerned, be offended by a simple historical description that mentioned the ancient Greeks? But a very, very good friend of mine, Shimon Steinmetz, you might know him as Fred McDowell, on Facebook, and I used to have a blog, and he's the editor, actually, for the Svarim blog. He repairs all the posts. He wrote me as follows, and I have to say that this would have gone completely over my head, but Mordechai Rabinovich has a chavrusa, I think like 3 to 4 times a week, private chavrusa with Rav Shlomo Fisher, Rosh Shiva of Itri, who some say is the greatest Talmud Chacham in the Lithuanian world. Rav Mordechai Rabinovich is a very close student of his. This is what my friend Shimon wrote to me. Yevanim, Greeks, was a particularly loaded term in Russia because Jews called the non-Jews Yevanim. They did this because many Ukrainians, he says, for historical purposes, this includes regions outside of Russia proper, like Ukraine. They did so because many Ukrainians were of the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church. Furthermore, The Russian Orthodox Church is an Eastern Orthodox Church, and in that way related to Greece as well. It's for this reason that Nathan Hanover called his account of the Khmelnytsky massacres, anyone remembers what he called it? He calls it Yevon Metsua. He refers to the Cossacks as Yevanim. And he goes on to say that we can see it from other sources as well. And Shimon says, supposedly, this was a play on the name Ivan. But he thinks this is probably just folk etymology. And more importantly, he says, we see that some works took it seriously and changed Yevanim to something else to avoid offending the censors. Yevanim, at the end of Ma'osor, was often changed. The last paragraph, as I recall, of Ma'osor, it says Yevanim, was often changed in Russia, in Russian text published in Russia, to Yehirim, arrogant. In other words, Mordechai Rabinovich is absolutely correct. There was this fear that Russians, when they saw something negative about Greeks, they would assume that it refers to the Greek Orthodox Church, and really the Russian Orthodox Church is simply a development from the Greek Orthodox Church, etc., etc. Let me give you some other examples. Rav Eliyahu Zinni pointed an example. I don't know if anyone knows Eliyahu Zinni. Eliyahu Zinni is a rabbi in Haifa. He teaches at Technion. He's a PhD in math. He comes from Algeria. Then he went to France. He has a yeshiva. It's called Or Vishua. It's a Hezri yeshiva in Haifa. He is really far on the right. I mean, in the religious Zionist world, I don't know how much of a following he has, but in the religious Zionist world, he's like more to the right, I think, of the typical Chardal. And you can read some of his articles on the Serugim website and other things. I have to say, though, he's a very, very big Talmud Chacham. He went after Avad Yosef on many things, and he's published a number of books. I bought the books from the yeshiva just a few months ago. Out of the blue, I get a package, and I communicated with him maybe two times in my life years ago when I was doing the classes on Rabbi Ben Amozig, because he's a big follower of Rabbi Ben Amozig. So I haven't had any contact with him probably in 6-7 years. Just out of the blue, like 3 months ago, I get a package with all of his books, his books on halacha, like three of the most recent volumes, which are very good. The problem was I already bought them myself, so I gave them to some deserving people. But in one of those volumes, he says as follows. He makes a very interesting point. If you look in Orachayim, and he's going to be right about this. Shows how Broyd's point is incorrect. In Orachayim 329:9, he writes that if listing, you know, robbers, marauders come, it's dealing with the halacha. If marauders come on Shabbos, what are they coming for? They're coming just for money. Are they coming to kill people? But because they're just coming for money, you can't violate Shabbos. However, we know that if we're not sure exactly why they're coming, if they're just typical robbers, stam listim heim horgei nefashot. You know, you can assume if people coming in to rob, they could also kill, so you can violate Shabbos, defend yourself. And he says, so what do? You go out with your weapons, umachalim alayim b'ta Shabbos. You violate Shabbos to fight them. Uvizman hakadmon, he says, in the earlier days, bizman shebeis hamigdash hayakayim, in the time that the beis hamigdash was standing, and the bandits would come to the border, then you do this. In other words, he takes it out. First of all, in Erevin, there's no mention of bandits listed. In Erevin, as Rabbi Zinni points out, the Talmud speaking uses non-Jews, nachrim. So already we see that the Aruch HaShulchan changes the word. Second of all, what is this business, the Aruch HaShulchan, about that this halacha of defending yourself only applies when the Beis HaMikdash stood? I mean, what could that possibly mean? That means if the Beis HaMikdash is not standing and the marauders are coming, we assume that they're just coming for money? The klal, that stam listim, that the typical marauder, also is a matter, could be a matter of life and death, so you don't defend yourself? I mean, how it's impossible that the Aruch HaShulchan ever could have intended this, as Rav Zinni says. In fact, Rivzini points out that Ravivat Yosef took this literally and says that this is wrong, absolutely wrong. How could the Aruch HaShulchan say this? The Shulchan Aruch disagrees with this. Of course, it applies at all times. Rivzini can't contain himself at this misunderstanding of Ravadia. He says, Umi Peti, you know, what type of fool, who's that, Shalo Yavin, who doesn't understand, Shabbat Aruch HaShulchan, quote, Sinzer Atatzmo, Mipachad Atzar, censored himself due to fear of the Tsar. Kefisha Asa Be'esrat Nakamot, Sifra says, he did tens of times. Upela Niskava Mimeni, it's a great wonder. Ech HaGon Ravad Yosef, oh, he's clean, but how did Ravad Yosef not recognize this? Okay, Ravad Yosef wasn't an Ashkenazi. He didn't maybe have this appreciation of who the Tsar was, but still, it's crazy, as Rassini says, to say that the halacha, well, what is this? What is the fact that there's a base of understanding have to do with the principle that a typical bandit, you also have to be worried he's going to kill you? But did you see anything here or in any of these other cases that Rivzini and other mentioned? There's nothing. It's not in the small print at the bottom of the page. What Broid is referring to, that there's a few times, as I recall, where the Aruch HaShulchan will say some halacha, and then it will have a little asterisk at the bottom and says, but it doesn't apply today, you know, among the non-Jews we're living in. Okay, fine. That's also censorship. But the point is that, contrary to what Broid thinks, thought, inside the Aruch HaShulchan itself, you have examples of censorship, self-censorship. And that's an example, just another example. I found that the Sansino Talmud also, you know, that I mentioned that the passage is derived from Erevin 45a, and it uses the word nachrim, if non-Jews come upon you. And for some reason, Sansino translates it, if foreigners besiege Israelite towns. What do you mean foreigners? It's nothing to do with foreigners. Nachrim doesn't mean foreigners. The translator knew it wasn't. I'm not sure why he felt the need to twist it. We understand why the Aruch HaShulchan, because you don't want to have a situation where a text published in Tsarist Russia is talking about a scenario where non-Jews come upon the Jewish town, robbers, and Jews take up arms to defend themselves. Jews are not supposed to have arms. That's the furthest thing that you want the government to think, that Jews are ever going to take up arms to do anything. So we can appreciate, we can understand that. Let me give you another example of censorship in the Aruch HaShulchan. Again, without the bracket, without this asterisk, or I shouldn't even mention it. It's so ridiculous. This is another example. If you look in Yoredeya, section 252, Dine Pidyon Shluyim Bizman HaKadmon. The laws of redeeming captives, and notice he says, in the earlier days, the Zmana Kadmon, he says as well that the law of Pidyon Shvuyim doesn't apply in civilized countries, only in Asia and Africa. Where does it apply for? He says, he quotes the Rambam about that you have to redeem captives if they've been taken, you know, people are in prison. And he says, oh, that was only Bizman Kadmon. And also in far places, like in the deserts of Asia and Africa, in which they people are, you know, the travelers, they grab them and they put it in prison. You know, the Aruch HaShulchan might have meant it, that in America, places like America, someone's in prison. There's no notion of pidyon shvuyim. We had that scandal when the Japanese boys were smuggling drugs, not Japanese, Hasidic boys were smuggling drugs into Japan. And then when they're caught, all of a sudden it's pidyon shvuyim. We have to redeem them. It's a famous story. It's brought down. When one of these Haredi criminals went to jail, they went to Rosh Hashanah Arbach to ask him to sign something for Pidyon Shvuyim, you know, and release the captives. And Rosh Hashanah asked what he did, and he explained. And he said, well, then maybe it's good. He should sit in jail for some time to learn not to do it again. However, the idea that that it doesn't apply to Tsarist Russia, that a Jew arrested and sentenced to prison in Tsarist Russia, well, first of all, the arrest would probably not be appropriate. Conviction would probably not be appropriate, and for a Jew to be in jail in Tsarist Russia is itself a sakana, a danger of life. So here's an example where there's no question that he's not speaking frankly. So you're going to say to yourself, well, how is this right? Here we're having this big machokes, you know, what the Aruch HaShulchan means. He's confusing us because he's saying things, and now we're saying it doesn't, it's not true. The only thing I can say is it's sort of like the beginning of Svarim, when you open them up and they say that, you know, all these laws only apply for these, you know, the the far reaches of Asia. It doesn't apply to the non-Jews we live in. There was an internal language that everyone knew what it meant. And I think assuming I'm correct, that the Aruch HaShulchan did not intend any of these things, I don't think the Aruch HaShulchan was at the place that he understood what it meant to live in a country like England or in America, a democratic country, where he could even imagine the idea that there wouldn't be a anti-Semitism of the sort that we used to have, that he could say that there's no such thing as Pidyon Shvuyim and there's no such thing as Mesira. Obviously, he knew that Britain was better than Tsarist Russia, but to the extent that he thought that it meant a complete revision of the halachot, I can't imagine that at all. How, you know, he's living in the middle of Russia. What does he know about what it means? Especially in the 19th century, you know, England wasn't so, it's not like today. I would think that the Aruch HaShulchan in his mind assumed that everyone reading this would understand what I'm talking about. And that's the whole point, that you have deniability, plausible deniability. The censor reads it, sees one thing. How can he attack Rav Epstein for the halacha? Rav Epstein does exactly what they say he has to do. Say that doesn't apply today. The fact that the Jews themselves know, well, it doesn't mean that. What are you going to do? You can't, the censors can't control people's minds. You can only do what the government insists. Write it down or say it in a sermon. But everyone understands differently. Similarly, as I said, he says later on in Yoredeya that in our land, we have no authority to accept converts because the Dina de Machus Adina, whoever heard of such a thing, that because the law says you can't accept converts, you're not allowed to accept converts, of course you can accept converts. It doesn't mean you have to. If there's a danger, it's very dangerous. In Spain, for instance, it was very dangerous. They wouldn't accept anyone as a convert. I'm talking pre-expulsion. They would send them to some other land, but at least most of the time. But in theory, if someone wanted, some rabbi wanted to take a chance and convert someone, and someone's going to say it's a problem, it's against halacha, of course not. The late Henkin, Eitam Henkin, points out that in the first, I didn't even realize this, in the first volume of Orach Chaim, the censor made him write, instead of when he's speaking about various halachot that appear in tractate Avodah Zarah, what does he write? He doesn't write Avodah Zarah. He writes Avodah Kochavim. That's because the censor, they didn't want, they took offense that Avodah Zarah, if you say Avodah Zarah, well, Avodah Zarah can refer to Christianity. Say Avodah Kochavim, and we know Akum. We know, but obviously every Jew knows when it says Akum, it doesn't just mean ancient, it doesn't mean ancient Babylonians or Canaanites or anything like that. But it's the same thing here, Masachat Avodah Kochavim. You don't see this in the later volumes, incidentally. It's only in the first volume of Orach Chaim. If you want to see it, you can look on Orach Chaim 224, it's Reish Chaf Dalet Gimel, and you can see that. Oh, okay, before I go on, I didn't realize I printed out the Aruch HaShulchan. Oh, and then I'll stop after I read this. What we're going to talk about next is, we'll do this next week. We might need two more classes, the Aruch HaShulchan's influence, where I'm going to make the case, the decline of it, what I believe, how his influence has declined. And then I want to speak about a number of halachot in the Aruch HaShulchan that are of great interest. You know, whether he broke new ground or came up with interesting ideas, controversial or even not controversial, but significant. I just want to end, and then I'll take questions and comments. I hear the Aruch HaShulchan, the Tzitz Eliezer, it's in volume 19, Siman Nunbet. Let me just read you the conclusion. Gambar Kochalakum, even if you're doing non-Jewish courts, Nira Shiesh Chiluk Bazeh, there's a separate differentiation here. Bein Medinot Pariot, between the savage kingdoms, Ubein Medinot Neorot, and the enlightened kingdoms, Ukadmatsinu Shemachalik Bechazot, Aruch HaShulchan, Bechoshin Mishpat, etc., etc. And then he quotes that the passage which I read you. And Umuchach, he says, Me Aruch HaShulchan. It's obvious from the Aruch HaShulchan. Shalo kivim bedvarav, rak mishum malchut. The Aruch HaShulchan was not only saying this, for the eyes of the kingdom, because he goes on and give examples of kingdoms that were far away from where he lived. In other words, why the Aruch HaShulchan say, why does he have to mention England? And then he adds at the end of the tshuva, after he signed his name, so that was the letter that was sent, and then it was published, it seems he added something else, and he says, nevertheless, even though you can hand over to enlightened kingdoms, the Jews, you still can only do it with a reshut beitin. In other words, not every individual, but a beistin. The beistin could decide, if the beistin was asked, and if it was an enlightened kingdom, the beistin could do it. This is sort of like the Aguda's current position, that you're allowed to go to the government, but you still cannot do it on your own. But you still have to get permission from a beistin. I always found this strange, because what does this mean? If God forbid, if some guy breaks into my house and rapes my wife, or some guy breaks into my house and robs my house, and I have my video camera, I see who did it. Do I have to go to beistin before I go to the police and say the guy raped my wife, the guy stole my house? Of course not. No one ever said you have to do that. So why do I have to go to beistin to ask permission to go if some guy abused my child? I've asked some of them this. No one's ever been able to explain to me what's going on here. Because no one would assume in the prior case that you go to a beistin. But in any event, I think the Aguda position is sort of like what Rabbi Waldenberg is saying, that what this does, it gives the permission for the rabbis. The problem, of course, is I'm not dealing with the case of handing over, let's say, a criminal to the government, but a general criminal. But when we deal with the sexual abuse, the problem was that we saw over and over again that the rabbis wouldn't do it because of the rabbinic boys club. They wouldn't want to hand over their own colleagues. So it didn't actually work properly. That was part of the problem. Okay, let me take some questions or comments. Let's see. Going back. Shlomo says he sees Dr. Mark is a great scholar that talks to women. No, I don't talk. It was email. She emailed me. So I... Moshe asks, was that a maskil concern to acquire more rights from the government along the lines of Ribal's activism? In other words, does Rabbonim agree with his concern? Oh, you're talking about the land. It's interesting. I don't know of any other rabbis who make the case that I'll read it for you. He says it's quite surprising to me, because what do the rabbis want people to have land? He says... he talks about the artisans who make their living, they live in poverty. He says, it's because we are denied the right to purchase land that we wander around aimlessly. It is inevitable, because of the pressure of poverty, people commit some deceitful actions. And he says one more thing. If only our exalted government would be gracious to permit all Jews to purchase a small parcel of land, then they would see with their honest eyes how we would with joyful hearts farm the land. So the Aruch HaShulchan acknowledges that there is some Jewish criminality, but he says they have, they're forced into it because they can't make a living and everything. I don't know of any other examples of rabbis in Eastern Europe asking, let us farm the land, and then we'll be, it'll be a wholesome activity. I mean, the Maskilim made a big deal about this. The idea being that being a merchant involved with money, it encouraged corruption, and working the land is a much healthier activity. The non-Jews used to attack the Jews because they said they're a bunch of weaklings and they didn't want to have any real labor. The truth is that the Jews didn't have the opportunity in modern times. So that is, I don't know. I've never seen anything like it. Baruch says Glenn Dinner is a Magid Shir at Sarah Lawrence College. That is correct. And he wrote an interesting book on the spread of Hasidut in Poland. He wrote a book on the Jewish tavern keepers, and he wrote a very, very interesting article on Rav Elio of Gryditz. What's his last name? Elio Gryditz, who was one of the last in Germany, like the last Makubo in Germany. Someone's going to write it, and he was not just a Makubo, he was a saint where the people would sit. Yivo has a couple thousand of these little notes that people, like, they give Hasidic Rebbes that they gave to him. And he wrote a whole article about this. So that's Glenn Dinner. Yeah. David Eisen says, William Nakash. Oh, that's the person's name. Thank you. Baruch points out Russia, United Kingdom. Moshe says no one says Malchus, they say Medina Shel Chesed. You're right, sorry, they say Medina Shel Chesed, not Malchus Shel Chesed. Although I think Rav Moshe might say Malchus Shel Chesed. I don't know. Does he say Medina Shel Chesed? I think earlier on they might have said it, but they say Medina Shel Chesed. But I think some say Malchus Shel Chesed. I'll check on that. Yeah, they also say Dina Malchus Adina in the Haredi world. Certainly the leadership does, but I don't know. It's hard to know because there's sometimes a wink because there's a number of tshuvot in which explain why you're allowed to cheat the government and when you're allowed to cheat the government and why Dina Malchus Adina doesn't apply because, let's say we're funding, our money's going to fund immoral things in the public school system. Yes, the Haredi world is varied, 100%, should not be portrayed as monolithic, definitely. Greek Orthodox Church, yes. Yav HaMetzul, yes. Okay, prisoners are not called Shvuyim. Prisoners of the government are called a Surim, as written by Yossi and Paro. Yeah, but today they're called Shvuyim, 100%. They're called Pidyon Shvuyim. The campaign to free, every time there's a campaign to free someone, it's Pidyon Shvuyim. Today they're called, you're speaking linguistically, fine, but is there video evidence of the abuse? No, but it's the same thing, though. If my wife would tell me, for example, that she was attacked by someone, would anyone say that if you come home and your wife tells you that someone came in and attacked her, beat her up or anything, and there's no video, that we don't believe her? That we have to go to a Basin to ask the Basin before we go report someone? I never heard of such a thing before. Yes, there are Gedolim who speak to women, and there are Gedolim who didn't speak to women. Look, the Ger Rebbe, they say, doesn't speak to anyone who's a Mechal Shabbos. Gutmacher, yes, thank you, Reli Gutmacher. Kvitlech, they sent him to... Baruch says links earlier regarding Russian-UK relations were related to the argument the UK relations were friendly to the time of the Aruch HaShulchan. No, but Broy just simply said, according to Wikipedia, art is not a simple, clear, varied. Yeah, of course it varied. And the fact that all these kings were related to each other, but they still went to war. But the idea that he portrays it as if this is, you know, they're at war or something, and therefore it wasn't the case at all, and it wouldn't have been a problem mentioning... England or anything like that, it's not going to offend Britain. On the contrary, it's not going to offend, sorry, Tsarist Russia. It makes Tsarist Russia look good that everyone knows that Britain or France, you know, were considered enlightened. Okay. Well, thank you all. I see we already reached 10 o'clock. Eve, I don't know if Eve's still with us. Okay. She had a question or a comment, but, we'll pick up again next week, either one more classes or two more classes. Just a final comment. Obviously, Baruch, I don't know how often you've been with me. Well, clearly, when you say the Haredi world is monolithic. However, on this matter, it's not monolithic. However, on this matter of the sexual abuse issue, we have the official statements of the Aguda. And the Aguda is the most left wing, I think, in America. Of the Haredi world. I don't, you know, if you want to look at the Hasidic world and their arguments, they didn't even get into the sophisticated arguments of the Aguda. From their standpoint, you know, you never can turn a Jew over ever to the non-Jewish authority if you can. The Aguda's position was much more nuanced, but still it required, and I believe, according to some interpretations, it still does require as we speak. It's not clear in the Aguda. You have different interpretations going to a rabbi before turning someone in. In any event, we'll have to, the Haredim left of Aguda? I don't know. I think if you go left of Aguda, you're not really Haredi. You're Haredi light or Chardal or something like that. I don't think David Lichtenstein qualifies as a Haredi. Okay, good night, everyone.